You know, as Americans, maybe, I don't know, I'm an American, so I can only speak from that perspective, but as Americans, there's this kind of ethos that we live in, and it's the idea that we should be able to live and that there should be no limits placed on us. You go to like a high school graduation ceremony or something, and that's the kind of thing you hear. It's, you could do whatever you want. You have unlimited opportunities in front of you. You just go out there. You work hard enough. You follow your dreams. You follow your passions. And it'll work out. And yet, if you've gone down that road of thinking, man, I want to live life with no limits. I don't want anybody to tell me what to do. I don't want any like boundaries placed around my life. I just want to do whatever I want and pursue whatever I want for as hard as I want to go. What is down that road is exhaustion. What is down that road is actually burnout. What is down that road is nothing really, really positive. What is down that road is you get kind of, you get into your middle age and you start to figure out, actually, I can't do that. I can't keep running at this pace forever. I'm tired. You start to understand that there are things that you just can't do. I was talking with a guy this morning, a young guy in our church, and he's going to do college athletics. And I was kind of chuckling to myself because I thought, man, do it while you can do it. Because there's like a very real like time where it's like, well, it'd be kind of fun, but I would be dead probably if I tried to embark on anything like that, right? It inevitably finds you. And the reality is that we are finite beings. We have this desire in us, I think, to be infinite beings. That's to be like God, but we are actually finite beings. And the ethos that you can have it and you can do it all and there should be no limits placed on you, it's actually a disaster. I started the sermon series on Sabbath by talking about the idea that about 1 in 5 Americans deals with some form of mental illness. And there's many reasons for that, but I think one of the reasons is that we as a culture, we have rejected the idea that we are finite. We want to live as if we are infinite. As if there are no limits that ought to bound our lives. And so this morning, as we consider once again the idea of Sabbath, every time I read through the Bible and I read the chapter that we're going to look at, I just am like, what? It is absolutely countercultural, wild, what God was calling his chosen people, the nation of Israel, to do, the practical limits that he was calling them to set as they pursued a Sabbath kind of living. So if you have your Bibles, you want to turn with me to the book of Leviticus. Leviticus is in the Old Testament. Leviticus is one of those books that, if you've ever read through the Bible, Genesis is interesting. It's got all these stories, all this action going on. Exodus, there's a lot of action, but then there's this stuff that starts to happen. It's like this law where God is instructing his people. And then you get to Leviticus, and Leviticus is all law, the whole thing. That's where you really bog down. If you're going straight through the Bible in a reading program, generally you get bogged down in like Leviticus and Numbers. And if people are going to stop their Bible reading program, that's where they fall down. So we're going to go to Leviticus this morning. you're welcome. And we're going to consider this question. What does the Bible say about practical limits? What does the Bible say about what I want to call Sabbath living or the Sabbath way of life? So this is Leviticus 25, 1 to 22. This is page 103 or thereabouts in the Bibles that are underneath the chairs. If you don't have one, we believe the Bible is the Word of God, that our Creator wants to speak to us through His Word. And so if you don't have a Bible, I'd encourage you to grab that Bible that's there underneath the chair, take it home with you as a gift from us at the church. Pastor Matt, who started the service, he puts together every month a Bible reading plan. If you stay on that plan for 2.5 years, you'll have read through the entire Bible. It kind of walks slowly. It's about 5, maybe 10 minutes. A day. We have those on the resource wall, so I'd encourage you to take a Bible, grab a Bible reading plan, and open the Word for yourself, and ask God to speak to you. You know, we just sang about abiding. We said we have to abide. He's our life. Well, one of the ways we live that out is by being in the Scriptures and letting the Scriptures abide in us. So if you don't have one, please take one home. Leviticus chapter 25, verses 1 to 22 is our text this morning. The Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel, and say to them, when you come into the land that I give you, the land shall keep," and here's our word, "a Sabbath to the Lord." We've been talking about Sabbath in the context of one day a week, one day out of every seven as rest. This is a new way of speaking about the Sabbath, though. Verse 3, "For 6 years you shall sow your field, and for 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in its fruits. But in the seventh year, there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field or prune your vineyard. You shall not reap what grows of itself in your harvest or gather the grapes of your undressed vine. It shall be a year of solemn rest for the land. The Sabbath of the land shall provide food for you, for yourself, and for your male and female slaves, and for your hired worker and the sojourner who lives with you, and for your cattle and for the wild animals that are in your land. All its yield shall be for food." Verse 8, "You shall count 7 weeks of years." These two things kind of go together. The first part, 1 through 7, and then 8 to 22. They're contiguous with one another. "You shall count 7 weeks of years, 7 times 7 years, so that the time of the 7 weeks of years shall give you 49 years. Then you shall sound the loud trumpet on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement, what the Jewish people call Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. You shall sound the trumpet throughout all your land. And you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty through the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you when each of you shall return to his property and each of you shall return to his clan. That 50th year shall be a jubilee for you. In it you shall neither sow nor reap, what grows of itself, nor gather the grapes from the undressed vines, for it is a jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You may eat the produce of the field. In this year of jubilee, each of you shall return to his property. And if you make a sale for your neighbor or buy from your neighbor, you shall not wrong one another. You shall pay your neighbor according to the number of years after the jubilee, and he shall sell to you according to the number of years for crops. If the years are many, you shall increase the price. And if the years are few, you shall reduce the price, for it is the number of crops that he is selling to you. You shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. Therefore, you shall do my statutes and keep my rules and perform them, and then you will dwell in the land securely. The land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and dwell in it securely. And if you say," and here's the question, "if you say, what shall we eat in the seventh year? If we may not sow or gather in our crops, I will command my blessing on you in the sixth year so that it will produce a crop sufficient for 3 years. When you sow in the eighth year, you will be eating some of the old crop. You shall eat the old until the ninth year when its crop arrives." There you go. I don't know if you've ever read that before, but Leviticus 25. It always, whenever I read through the Bible, I always think, my goodness, this is absolutely wild. What God was calling his chosen people to do in faith. This Sabbath way of living had much deeper implications than just one day out of every seven a week. It had like earth-shaking survival-level implications. And so we are going to first look at what did Sabbath living require for God's people? And I want to spend some time, because there's not a one-to-one correlation between what it required for them and what it requires for us. We're different people living in a different time under a different set of circumstances. We relate to God in a different way, so we can't just say, well, this is what it said in Leviticus 25, so we have to do the exact same thing. I don't think it's quite that simple. But there are principles here that I think show us how God has designed us and designed the world. So we're going to look at the requirements of Sabbath living. Then we're going to look at the result of it. The result of this. This chapter, like no other place that we've looked at, puts Sabbath living and the result of it in stark contrast. Like it highlights what it was really, really, really about in a way that one day out of every seven maybe hasn't communicated to us up to this point. So we're going to talk about that, and then what does that mean for us at the end? So as we start, what was the requirement of Sabbath living. Sabbath living, if the Jewish people were to do what God actually said, it required something of them. It required, and we see this here, putting practical limits in their lives. Very practical limits in their lives. It required them to do that. And I would say to us, if we are going to practice Sabbath living, it's going to require practical limits. There's practical things that we are going to have to do or not do in order to live observing the Sabbath. It's going to require very practical things. If you haven't been with us, the word Sabbath comes to us from the first story of the Bible. In Genesis chapter 2, after God created everything, it says on the seventh day, he rested on the seventh day. Now, he didn't rest because he was tired, because he doesn't get tired. He rested as an example to us, to his people, of what is good for us. That one day in every seven, we would put down our labor and we would focus it on him as our creator. The word rested there is the word Sabbath. In Exodus 20, after he's brought his people out of slavery, they go to Mount Sinai, where they are here in our text. It started with that. And he gives them the Ten Commandments. And one of the Ten Commandments says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. It was supposed to be something that they would remember. And part of this remembering was not just remembering that God had created them this way for Sabbath, but that he had redeemed them out of slavery in Egypt. It says in the book of Deuteronomy, they were to use it to not just remember his acts of creation, but also his acts of redemption. So as we come to Leviticus 25, we see some really, really, really fascinating things. Verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai when he was making the covenant with his people. Verse 2, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land that I give you, God had promised to Abraham, their descendant, hundreds of years before, he said, I'm going to give you this, the land that you're going to go into and sojourn in. They'd been in Egypt. God delivered them from Egypt. They were on their way, wandering from Egypt up to the promised land. It says, when you come into the land that I give you, the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord. And that phrase, the land that I give you, I think is important. And as we think about ourselves, and as we think about the things that we have, and as we think about our time and our schedule, as if we think about what would it mean to practice like Sabbath living in my own life, I think this is a wonderful place to start, the idea of ownership. Because one of the issues we have as Americans is we think we own it all. But here it says, into the land that I give you. God was highlighting for his people where it was coming from. That he was going to give them the land that he had promised to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. He was going to bring them into the land. We see that in the rest of the Bible. He brings them into the land. He gives them the land. And it's good land and it's flowing with all the things that they need. It's not perfect, but it's a good place for a home for them. But God wanted them to remember, it's not yours. It's a gift. I gave it to you. And we are not given a land in the same way that the nation of Israel was given a land. We have, you have maybe a home, or maybe you have land, or you have a business, you have possessions, you have things. And there wasn't a promise hundreds of years ago to your ancestors that they were going to get those things like there was to the Jewish people. But in the same way, you and I have been given everything that we have. And so when we think about Sabbath and Sabbath living, what does that look like? I think this is one of the foundational realizations. Because if we think it's all ours and we get to do with it whatever we want, then that's going to lead us a certain way. We're just going to work, try to get more. There's going to be no limit on our production, on our consumption. There's going to be no limit on our schedules. But if we look at it as everything that I have is a gift from God, and he has distinct things that he wants to say about that, I think that changes it. This is important, the land that I give you. God is the ultimate owner, not us. Verse 3, for 6 years, you shall sow your field, and for 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in its fruits. Now, this was a totally agrarian society. And if you can imagine, they didn't have trains, planes, or automobiles at this time. Which meant, if you wanted to eat food, your area had to supply that food. Maybe they could bring some grain in from a different region, but it couldn't come from around the world. If there was a famine in your area, in your city, you were just in trouble. They were totally dependent on what the ground would produce. And so into that, God says, yeah, 6 years, do the normal thing. Sow, plant, reap, prune, gather in, as you normally would. But then look what he says in verse 4. But in the seventh year, there shall be a Sabbath, a rest, of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field or prune your vineyard. Verse 5, you shall not reap what grows of itself in your harvest or gather the grapes of your undressed vine. It shall be a year of solemn rest for the land. Verse 6, the Sabbath of the land shall provide food for you, for yourself, for your male and female slaves, and for your hired worker, and the sojourner who lives with you, and for your cattle, and for the wild animals that are in your land. It's really inclusive. Everybody, even the wild animals that are in your land, all its yield shall be for food. This is what God was telling his people. 6 years, go out, plant. Do the normal thing that you do to survive. Sell, buy. But seventh year, not just the seventh day, the seventh year, you're not to do those things. You're supposed to let the land rest. Now, we kind of understand from our modern scientific agricultural understanding, this would have been really good. They didn't have fertilizers. They didn't have all the hybrid crops like we have today. They didn't have all the advantages. They were just planting what grew and sowing. But even today, we look back on this, we think, well, there's probably good reasons why God said this to his people. You can deplete the soil if you just plant and plant and plant and plant and don't do anything. That these people may not have been aware of. But that's kind of to the side. What God wanted was that his people would be people who were practicing Sabbath living in profound ways that put very real, practical limits on their life. I mean, can you imagine? Now, the Jewish people, we're going to see, they never really did this. They just blew right by Leviticus 25. They were like, nope, that's too much for us. But can you imagine if they had actually done this? You get to the end of the sixth year, you put everything up, and you don't get it out the next year? You don't go out, you don't do the normal thing? Like, this is a profound, practical limit on their life. It's profound. It's so profound that they never even did it. It was here, but they didn't obey it. We know that in 2 Chronicles, after they had been exiled, hundreds of years after the command was given, 2 Chronicles 36, it says, he, Nebuchadnezzar, took into exile to Babylon those who had escaped from the sword, and they became servants to him and to his sons until the establishment of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah. And then it says this, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days that it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. What God, through the chronicler, is telling us is that the Jewish people, they never kept this command. They didn't obey it. They didn't keep the Sabbath. And so God had counted those Sabbaths out, and their time in exile was equal to the number of Sabbath years that they should have kept, 70 years. They were unable to keep these practical limits. But as we keep reading in verse 8, it doesn't stop with just 1 year out of every six. He goes even further. Verse 8, you shall count 7 weeks of years, or 7 groups of 7 years, 7 times 7 years, so that the time of the 7 weeks of years shall give you 49 years. So seven groups of 7 years. Verse 11, after the 49th year, that 50th year shall be a jubilee for you, a celebration. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of itself, nor gather the grapes from the undressed vines. For it is a jubilee, it shall be holy to you. You may eat the produce of the field. So here's the picture. This was to be a 50-year cycle for the Jewish people. The white bars, those represent just normal years where they could sow and they could reap and they could have normal production. Everything was normal. The orange are the years of Sabbath. And after every seven cycles, there was to be a second year. I've got it in green up there, the 50th year. And you look at that, so that means there's 6 years of normal production, and then there's 1 year of Sabbath, and then following that, there's a second year of Sabbath. It wasn't just for Sabbath, though. Verse 13, in this year of Jubilee, there's also other stuff going on. Every 50 years, each of you shall return to his property, and if you make a sale to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor, you shall not wrong one another. You shall pay your neighbor according to the number of years after the Jubilee. And he shall sell to you according to the number of years for crops. If the years are many, you shall increase the price. If the years are few, you shall reduce the price, for it is the number of crops that he is selling you. You shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. So not only were they supposed to take these years off, but there was something else going on underneath the surface. See, as they went into the land, God was going to like apportion it out, and each tribe was going to get certain places. You go to the book of Joshua, it's very specific. Interesting study to go look at like what the tribe of Benjamin got, and what the tribe of Judah got, and what the tribe of Zebulun got, and what the tribe of Issachar got. They're different apportionments. These were given to them by God through Joshua, as the land for each tribe. And God wanted each tribe to have its place that he had given them. But inevitably, on the borders of these places, there was borders, and there would be buying and selling back and forth of the land. But here, at the beginning of the whole thing, God is saying, but every 50 years, I want the land to go back to those original owners. We don't get this. We think, hey, I bought it, it's mine. But what God was doing was trying to set up this system of thinking about the world and the way we interact with the world and the way we work in the world that was like so countercultural and so revolutionary that it would have just turned over everything. You're supposed to take 2 years off, and in that second year, land is supposed to revert to the original owners. Talk about practical limits. Practical limits on, you think, on work? Practical limits on production? I think of this. I'm not suggesting that you take a, please don't hear Pastor Seth saying, you don't go to your boss tomorrow and say, well, my pastor said yesterday, I have been working here 7 years, 6 years, so I need to take all of next year off and you have to pay me for it. Don't do that. Okay, I don't want to get an email or a call or a text from anybody's boss because you went home and you said, you know what, I don't have to work for the next year. That's not the point of this sermon. The point of the sermon is that Sabbath living requires very practical limits on our lives. And those limits were one thing for the Jewish people. Those limits might be something else for us. But if we ask ourselves, what would we do? What kind of practical limits would we have to put in place? If you were in those Jewish people, don't you think you might be more prone to save stuff up during those 6 years? You might be less prone to like go too far financially, to really extend yourself because you know a year is coming where you're not going to be able to produce as normal. It's very practical. And I think for us, Sabbath living forces us, one of the things it forces us to do is to put practical limits in our lives. Very practical. What would it mean to us if we really said, you know what, one day a week, I'm not going to work. I'm going to use that day to remember how God created me. I'm going to use it for refreshment. I'm going to use it for renewal. I'm going to use it for remembering all that God has done for me and connecting with Him. What kind of limits would that place on us? There's an old business leadership example that, you know, you have all these buckets and you have this little glass jar, and that jar represents your life, and you could there's like water, and there's sand, and there's gravel, and there's like little rocks, and then there's big rocks. And the thing is, hey, we want to get it all into that thing. It represents all the things in your life. If you've ever seen the example, they always start, they pour in the water first, and then the sand on top of the water, and they put the gravel on top of the sand, and then they put the little rocks in. And by the end, they've got these big rocks, and they're trying to jam them in, and the point is you can't get them in. But if you start with those big rocks, this is where we get the saying, put in the big rocks first. If you start with the big rocks, you put them in, everything else will go in, because it will fill in. What God is saying with Sabbath living is, I want to place something in your life. I want to place a thing for rest. I want to place a rock of renewal. I want to place the rock of remembrance into your life. But what it's going to take is it's going to require very practical limits on us. Sabbath living requires practical limits in our lives. Sabbath living, it does this. It teaches us to trust God. This is what I think is at the foundation of this. If you want to live in a Sabbath kind of way, the end result of that is you are going to learn to trust God in new ways that you have never trusted Him before. It teaches us to trust God. Verse 18, he says, therefore, you shall do my statutes and keep my rules and perform them. And it's so fascinating, the order here. He gives them a command about Sabbath living, and he just puts it out there. He says, okay, you're going to keep the Sabbath year. You need to keep the year of Jubilee. You need to let land revert to its original owners. You need to do these things. And then he says, the and then part. If you do this, and then, this is what I'm going to do. You will dwell in the land securely. The land will yield its fruit. You will eat your fill and dwell in it securely. You know what we want? We want that first part, the promise. We want him to say, you'll dwell in the land securely. The land will yield its fruit. You'll eat your fill and dwell in it securely. We want that on the front end. We want assurance that that's going to happen. And then we'll say, well, and if that happens, then I will do what God has commanded. The problem with that is not the way it works. And the way it doesn't work, the reason it doesn't work that way is because it would require no faith. So what God says is, you need to do this. You need to obey me to his people. And when you obey me, there will be things that happen that will be good in your life connected to that. This is always the way of obedience. Obedience requires great faith and trust in God. He says something, and we have a choice. Are we going to obey it? Or are we going to say, yeah, that sounds too hard. Yeah, that's good for other people, but not for me. And this is why Sabbath living teaches us to trust God, because it forces us to make practical limits in our lives in faith that God is going to do what he said he's going to do. And the question here at the end is the natural question, is God really going to show up? If you say, what shall we eat in the seventh year? If we may not sow or gather in our crop? That's the question we have. If I obey God, if I step out in faith, if I put the practical limits in my life, if I do what he says in his word, is he really the kind of God he's going to answer? That's the question. So he answers the question for us, verse 21. What kind of God is he? He's not a God. He's not seeking to just force you to do things. He wants you to do them for your good. Verse 21, I will command my blessing on you in the sixth year so that it will produce a crop sufficient for 3 years. When you sow in the eighth year, you will be eating some of the old crop. You shall eat the old until the ninth year when its crop arrives. He promises. I'm going to take care of you. You start living in a Sabbath kind of way as my person. Not legalistically, we talked about that last week. I'm going to take care of you. Sabbath living teaches us to trust God. It teaches us to trust God here as God. One of the things I think we want to be as Americans, we kind of in our heart of hearts, we want to be God. We want to have it all. We want to do it all. We want to control it all. That's the job description of somebody, but it's not me. That's the job description of the creator of the universe. Sabbath living teaches us to say, you know what? I'm not the creator of the universe. I'm not infinite. I'm not eternal. I'm not all powerful. Only He is. Sabbath living teaches us to trust God as our provider and sustainer. If we say, God, I'm gonna live in this way. One day out of every seven, I'm gonna rest and renew. I'm gonna limit myself. I personally think it's not addressed in here, but I think the discipline of giving and generosity is part of Sabbath living. When we say, Lord, you have provided this for me, and we give Him out of our first fruits, I think that's part of Sabbath living. And it's saying to Him, Lord, you are my provider and sustainer. I'm not. So what I can see is I can see the dollars and cents, and I can see them build up in my account, and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to be okay. When you release that, you say, Lord, you're my sustainer. You're my provider. I'm not going to just trust in what I can see. I'm going to trust in you. Lastly, Sabbath living teaches us who and reminds us who the real owner is. So if you think you're the real owner, then all the pressure is on your shoulders and my shoulders. But when He says, when you come into the land that I give you, He's the owner. There's lots of talk right now about inflation. It's high. Food is high. Gas is high. Stuff's high. I can get pretty worked up about it. Like, are we going to have enough? And it's good to be a good steward. The thought I had recently, though, was, you know what? It's ultimately, if I'm doing everything that I know how to do, who's responsible for providing for me and my family? It's Him. He's my provider. He's my sustainer. It's not my job. It's not my retirement account. It's not the U.S. economy. It's, you know, all those things are connected, and He uses a variety of means. But at the end of the day, He's the one. And Sabbath living was meant to teach us that in practical ways. So what does this mean for us? I'd just encourage you to think that I think the whole sermon series, this is what I want you to get out of this. Sabbath living is not something God comes down and He says, you know what? I want to take something from you. I want to take one day out of every seven so that you can't use it. I want to take your production away from you. No, no, no. He wants to give us something. So will we receive it? Will we receive His gift of practical limits on our life? Will we receive that? What practical limits do we need? That's a good question. We don't live in Israel. We don't have clans that were given specific land. We don't have those same kind of things that connect to us, but we have different things. What are the practical limits? I was thinking this week, one thing, and I'm speaking to myself. I'm very imperfect in this. I would encourage you, if you're going to practice Sabbath living, don't Sabbath primarily in front of a screen. Don't Sabbath primarily. I'm not saying you can't watch the Vikings or a movie or do something, you know. I'm not saying that. It's not legalistic. But don't just like, well, I'm going to Sabbath today, so I'm going to binge watch things for 12 hours. That's not going to renew you. It's not going to refresh you. Maybe our technology, you need to put it down, turn it off. Maybe that's a practical limit. Maybe you're going to have to say no to some stuff. I hate saying no to people. I heard somebody this week, I was out at the service at the fair, or not the service at the fair, the service at the fair is in a little bit, but I was out at the outreach of the fair. And yesterday we were walking around the fair, I was walking around with my family, and one of the guys that I'd done the outreach with, he was at the outreach because he's a better Christian than me. And I was just walking around the fair, enjoying the fair, and he's like, hey, you want to come like do the outreach? And I was like, no. And then I felt bad. Because I'm just walking around with the family, and here's this guy telling people about Jesus. But I think saying no, that was the right thing to do. I said no. And sometimes you have to say no. You have to say, you know what, I just can't do that right now. I can't add another thing. So maybe we need to use the N-word. We need to say no. We need to say no. When people ask us to do something. Another thing we might have to say no to is our own perfectionism. Anybody a perfectionist in here? You like everything done just perfectly. You like it to look nice. And your thought process is, I'm just going to work hard and it's all going to get done perfectly just like I want. You might have to say no to yourself. You might have to use the phrase, you know what? It's good enough. I've done all I can do. You may have to put financial limits. I mean, if you only work 6 days and the seventh day is devoted to rest, you may have to say no to like buying stuff. You may have to say no to your consumption. I remember when we were getting ready to buy our first house, Rebecca and I. It wasn't like a real fancy house. But we were the nightmare of all realtors. I'm not a realtor, but I imagine, you know. So we're buying a starter home, like bottom of the price range, right? Yeah, kind of home, and we insisted on being shown like 20 houses, right? They were working with us for months, I think, you know. So they're showing us these houses, and they're going to get like a pittance compared to what they normally get. And we'd go out and we'd look at houses, and we started hearing ourselves say things like this: "It would be nice to have an extra bedroom. Wouldn't it be nice to have an extra, like, garage stall? Wouldn't it be nice if we were in this neighborhood or that neighborhood? Wouldn't it be nice if we had a big backyard? Wouldn't it be nice if we had..." And yeah, it would be really nice. But if you add up all those things, it gets really expensive. Now, during the same time, we were taking this class called Perspectives on the World Christian Movement about what God is doing in the world. So we'd go house hunting in the morning, you know, like fill up with our like American, like it would be nice, all the stuff we want to have. And then at night, it was so great. We'd go and we'd hear about what God was doing in the world. And it was this great like counterbalance. And we ended up buying a house. We love that house, 780 West 9th Avenue. We had all of our daughters living in that house. We have tons of memories in that house, but it was nothing fancy. There's practical limits. But the nice thing about it is we were able to we had a balance. Because we balanced it out, we were able to give. Because we balanced it out, we were able to use the house for ministry. We had extra margin in our life that God could use. And that's part of the gift he wants to give. So here's the question: what practical limits would it take for you and I to practice Sabbath living? Lord, I just pray that you would help us to answer that question, that you would teach us what that means, that we would be people who have limits on our production, our hours of production. We have limits on our consumption. We have limits on our time, that we would have limits on our technology, Lord, not as legalistic things, but so that we can receive the gift that you want to give us, Lord, that we would be refreshed, renewed, that we would be connected to you, that we would have margin in our lives for others. Lord, we pray in your name. Amen.